Welcome to the President's Inbox, a CFR podcast about the foreign policy challenges facing the United States. I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. This week's topic is protests in Russia. With me to discuss the current protests that have swept across Russia in recent weeks and the arrest of the opposition leader Alexei Navalny is Maria Lipman. Maria is a senior associate for the Program on New Approaches to Research and Security in Eurasia at George Washington University. There she hosts the PONAR's Eurasia podcast. She also writes capsule reviews about books about Russia and Eastern Europe for Foreign Affairs. Maria, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Maria, here in the United States, Russia has been in the news for the last several weeks. After the return of Alexei Navalny to Moscow and his arrest, there have been at least two weekends of protests, quite sizable. I wonder, maybe you can sort of just tell us, since you're in Moscow, what the mood is in the capital city.
Well, of course, it depends on who we're talking about. Among the protest crowd, the mood, I think, is a mix of we've been there, we've done that, we were unafraid. Even those who were detained and roughed up, I think at this point in time, are proud of themselves, huge crowds, and indeed unafraid of police brutality. But of course, the mood is very different, I think, among the powers that be. We've heard very angry retorts from Putin's press man, from Dmitry Medvedev, former president and former prime minister, who referred to Alexei Navalny as a political villain or political adventurer. I'm sure the Kremlin is very busy right now and not happy about it. And I don't think the Kremlin has found a good response so far. But Moscow is a very big city, and I'm sure there are those who are not interested at all or who are actually unhappy to see crowds in the streets and inconveniences. On Sunday, January 31st, when the second protest took place, the city authorities cordoned off a huge swath of the capital, closing down several metro stations, which of course caused inconveniences for many of those who just went about their business.
Well, I have to say, residents of Washington, D.C. have a sense of what that is like, given the protests here in the United States on different issues over the last summer and, of course, in the weeks surrounding the American presidential inauguration. I'm curious, Maria, in your sense, why are we seeing protests now? I understand that Mr. Navalny came back in the middle of last month, and that's the proximate cause for the protests. His arrest and imprisonment. But a broader sense, why are we seeing protests in the second half of January that we didn't see, let's say, late in the fall of 2020?
Well, it's a combination of several things, but Alexei Navalny is very important here. His poisoning, his return to Russia, his defiance of very high risk of his arrest, which was what indeed happened. As soon as he set foot right in the airport, he was immediately arrested. And his fearlessness, because he did come back after what looks very much like an attempt to assassinate him. And as soon as he was jailed in Moscow, his team released yet another of his videos. He is very good at those videos in which, over the years, he exposed corruption at the high echelons of power. He is very good at explaining complicated schemes in an easy and very funny way, which is an important factor that makes those videos so attractive. And they are commonly watched by many millions of people. This time around, the number of views of this latest video was a mind-boggling 100 million views. Of course, individual people are much fewer, according to one estimate, just over 30 million, but this is quite a bit. And that video was different from his previous ones in that it targeted Putin personally. It told a story of what Alexei Navalny referred to as Putin's palace, that he described as the largest bribe Putin was given by members of his inner circle, with a lot of detail. Actually, it's an almost two-hour film with lots of documents cited, with people interviewed, with visualization. He could not, of course, Navalny's team could not get inside the building, but there was as much as they could do to visualize what was inside. But they were able to use a drone to fly over the palace, even though this is a no-fly zone, very heavily guarded. So that film was a breakthrough in that it made fun of Putin, who Navalny referred to as a gramps in the bunker. So thereby desacralizing the figure of the man who for 20 years has been unchallenged and uncontested. So the effect of the film and the call for joining a protest, again, since Navalny's arrest, I think combined produced huge crowds in not only in Moscow, St. Petersburg, of course, Russia's two largest cities, but also across Russia. And this is unusual. The fact that at least 120 cities and towns, estimates varied, had protest rallies on January 23rd, not just simultaneously, but also with the same chants. And I would say the most common chant was Putin is a thief. And people were unafraid to chant that. The geography itself was stunning. We never had that before. So many simultaneous rallies across Russia with the same chants, with the same message.
And Russia is a huge country. It spans 11 time zones. Continental United States is 3 time zones. So that's
indeed
quite significant.
It's a gigantic country. It's the largest landmass in the world. And from the Far East to Moscow and St. Petersburg, small towns, big cities had those protest rallies. So apparently the message of the film, the outrage over Navalny's arrest, and I think maybe a general sense of discontent over injustice, over inequality, huge disparity between the rich and the average Russians. I think the combination of those factors pushed people to take to the streets. And then amazingly, again, on January 31st.
Maria, I want to talk a little bit about Alexei Navalny because he's been at the center of the story. You're quite right. He seems to have mastered social media. I'll note that I see that he has more than 6 million YouTube subscribers and more than 2 million Twitter followers. I watched that video that you mentioned that has attracted 100 million views. The production values are quite high. It's really a riveting video. So clearly a lot of media savvy. But I think for most Americans and probably for most people outside of Russia, they know very little about Alexei Navalny, the person. Can you give us some sense of who he is, where he came from? I mean, we know he's an anti-corruption crusader, but perhaps not much more beyond that.
Navalny has been an anti-corruption crusader for a long, long time, but not just that. He is, I think, a natural-born politician in a country such as Russia, where public politics is virtually inexistent. And with his talent, his ability to work the crowd, he's handsome, he's funny, he's smart, he's quick in responding to developments. He's totally, completely fearless.
Well, that's obvious because he chose to come back to Moscow, risking imprisonment perhaps for a very long time.
Of course, that especially. But even before that, the Kremlin actually, up until quite recently, apparently thought that it was better to keep him at large than in jail and alive rather than dead. But this does not mean that he was not harassed. He was harassed all the time. Illegal proceedings, criminal proceedings were open against him. He spent time in jail many times, never for a long time, administrative arrests rather than criminal charges and sentences. But there were also sentences that were longer, but commuted to a suspended sentence. So there were all kinds of harassment, persecution, prosecution against him. And yet he always reemerged totally indomitable, totally fearless, always funny, always very witty, totally a people's man. And in addition to being an anti-corruption crusader, he also played a role almost 10 years ago from now in 2011 and 2012, when we had also a wave of mass protests at that point, mostly in Moscow, St. Petersburg, against a fraudulent parlamentary election in December 2011. Navalny played a role there. I remember him in those days. He was always surrounded by people. At that point, protests were peaceful. The police did not rough up people. Very, very few were detained, or almost nobody. And he was surrounded by an admiring crowd always because of what he is as a people's man. So it's this combination, fearlessness, human attraction, being a natural-born politician, being an anti-corruption crusader, telling people what they actually knew, but in a very entertaining and attractive way in his videos. Because, of course, people are aware of corruption. Of course, they're not shocked by the very fact, but the way those videos were done. And in recent years, he was able, against all odds, to establish the so-called Navalny's headquarters in many Russian cities. headquarters. These headquarters are teams of people loyal to Navalny, I think his strong supporters and sympathizers, who became active in time for local elections. And actually, in 2020, in some cities, they were even successful and won seats in local legislatures. Not because Navalny was there. Actually, he was poisoned as he traveled around those cities in summer. But even without him, some of his supporters were able to achieve electoral results, which is incredible because there is no alternative politics in Russia. And yet Navalny was able to establish this network of headquarters. This is not to say that he is an idol of a majority of Russians. Actually, when asked in public opinion polls whether they would want Navalny to become Russia's leader, Russia's president, very few people say so. People admire him for his courage. They absolutely admire his videos. But up until recently, at least, there was little trust in him as a potential national leader.
Let me ask you about that, Maria. Now. I mean, looking at Navalny, it's pretty clear that he has a critique of Putin. You summed it up in the protest chant, Putin is a thief. It's probably a little bit broader than that, in the sense Putin is surrounded by people that Russians regard as benefiting from corruption and stealing from the people. But does Navalny have a positive agenda that he is arguing for? Or is it that he's bringing together people who may not agree with him on what to do, but they agree with him that Putin or Putin's cronies aren't doing a good job for Russians as a whole?
Well, I would say that if Navalny were speaking in terms of political issues and the way he would like to reform the Russian economy or the Russian judiciary or what have you, I think he would have had even less attraction. People are, at least up until recently, I'm not sure how the current protest wave might evolve, but up until recently, there was very little interest in politics. It is generally assumed that politics is not for us, that politics is monopolized by those up above. People do not regard politics as a means that can make their lives better. There is no such perception in Russia. Politics is something that they deal with, not we people. And indeed, there hasn't been any political competition at the federal level, at the national level, ever since Putin became president. Actually, our last competitive federal election was the parliamentary election of 1999. Since then, all elections, parliamentary and presidential, have had preordained results. So Putin always emerged as the winner. And United Russia, the chief pro-Kremlin party, always won a majority of seats in the Russian Duma, the Russian legislature. So politics is of no interest to the people. And I think Navalny's strategy or tactics at this point has been correct. He attracted people by everything that I already spoke about. And there is indeed no positive program. I don't think people are interested in that. And this is the weakness, I think, of the protest itself, because it is much more emotional than it is political. There is no sense that we need to have our representative and demand that the powers that be meet with us and listen to us, and that we need a representation. We are so many, see how many we are. According to some estimates, Putin's opponents, let's put it this way, account for roughly one-third of the population today. But there is no sense of we need a representation. We need a party that would be represented in our legislature that will actually convey our interests and be our voice in the national legislature. This is a major weakness of this protest. It comes and goes. It rises and ebbs. We had such waves before. The largest before this one, before the current one, was in 2011 and 2012. Of course, after a while, such a protest inevitably ebbs. And people go back home, and there is nothing that they leave behind. There is no force, party, movement, what have you, that they can identify with, even if that party or movement, you know, would be out of the parliament. There is nothing there, just us who are good people and the bad government.
So that sounds like you're not building the momentum to really sort of change things in a fundamental way, which leads me to ask you, Maria, how are these protests viewed from the perspective of Mr. Putin, President Putin? I will note that he, as best I can tell, at least according to reports in the Western press, has refused to mention Navalny by name. I hear that he refers to him as, quote, the patient, end quote. But clearly, once Navalny decided that he was going to come back from Germany and go to Moscow, the the government mobilized quickly to put him in jail, which makes me think that they're concerned about him because they didn't let him run free. But obviously, by putting him in jail, you create the risk that you make him into a political figure, which appears to have happened. So can you sort of walk us through your understanding of how Mr. Putin and his government views this?
Indeed, up until recently, not just President Putin, but also all the loyalists, all the members of the establishment, dismissed him as insignificant and would never refer to him by name. He would be a blogger. He would be a Berlin patient when he was recovering after his poisoning there. He would be that man. He would be anything except Alexei Navalny, a person with a face and a name, and actually a rather broad public awareness even before his poisoning. So now this is no longer possible. Now that he is in jail, the government has done everything to demonstrate against their will, of course, to demonstrate that they take him very, very seriously. It was not just that he was arrested upon arrival. It was that his plane was diverted to a different airport so that he would not meet with those who came to meet him at the airport and express their sympathy and their support. So planes diverted, not just Navalny's plane, as we all understand. If one plane is diverted, this leads to a big commotion and even potentially, well, risks. So several planes diverted to different airports. You do not do this to somebody who is insignificant, who you dismiss as a nobody. And then, of course, he is arrested. And then when his video gained 100 million views, the government was forced to respond. And it responded, I would say, in a fairly ridiculous manner. Apparently, they didn't have a response for that. So, of course, they treat him very seriously. And I think, unfortunately, this means that he will probably now be locked up. As I mentioned, there was a long, long time when the government tolerated him, harassed him, persecuted him, but kept him mostly at large. Now, I'm afraid he'll probably be locked up for a long time. There are several cases already opened against him. Of course, he says, and broadly his sympathizers believe all those charges are trumped up, but the government, I think, most likely will keep him locked up for much longer.
I'm curious just on one point. In the fall, one of the big stories was the protest taking place in neighboring Belarus over President Lukashenko essentially stealing the election, demanding that he go. And there was a lot of talk about how those protests were being viewed in Moscow by the Kremlin, given, I guess, lukewarm feelings toward Mr. Lukashenko, but also concerns over what may be called, I guess, the contagion effect, that this might somehow influence politics or political views and emotions in Russia. Do you see any sort of spillover effect from that in what we're seeing in Russia, or is this sort of a side issue that isn't connected at all?
Well, of course, the Kremlin, and I'm sure Putin in particular, were watching the developments in Belarus very closely, and they were certainly highly concerned. This is a neighboring country, and it was different from what we are having in Russia these days. They had a really popular rebellion. The situation there was still different. They had a contender. They had a person, a woman, actually, who challenged Lukashenko openly. We don't have that. Navalny lost the ability to be part of any races as a restriction after one of the cases opened against him already some years ago. But over there in Belarus, probably we can think of it as a mistake made by Alexander Lukashenko, that he allowed this to happen, that he didn't nip it in the bud. So people had a leader, and people believed that the leader, Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, won and Lukashenko lost. Instead, they were informed that not only Lukashenko was the winner, but he won in a landslide, in an incredible landslide. So there, the cause was so obvious. We want our leader, the leader who we believe won, the leader from whom Alexander Lukashenko stole the election. And in a country of just 9 million people, this cause brought people together nationally very big time. All over the small country, people were taking to the streets and demonstrating their defiance in the face of brutalities that we don't have in Russia, but I have to say we don't have it yet. People are talking about the police acting very brutally on January 31st, more brutally than on January 23. Apparently, the Kremlin wants to put an end to this as quickly as possible. And this, of course, leads to brutality, not of a kind that we've seen in Belarus, but I'm afraid that we are moving in that direction.
Well, let me ask you about that, Maria, because I think it's an important point. There's obviously a question here as to what is President Putin's play now that he faces these protests. As you mentioned, Lukashenko relied heavily on state security forces to put down the protests. We have seen a ratcheting up of the use of police in Russia to put down or suppress the protests. Indeed, I think in a number of cities, there were exercises by security forces to sort of deter or intimidate people from coming out in the streets. But people are coming out onto the streets. And that raises the question whether you think Putin will rely heavily simply on suppression or whether we will see him try to sort of counterflank or outflank Mr. Navalny by, let's say, launching his own corruption investigation and potentially exposing corruption by people and punishing it as a way to sort of divert attention and show that he's listening to the complaints of the people.
Well, it's not that we don't have cases against corrupt officials and big-time corruption initiated by the government. We've got plenty. The Kremlin pretends that there is no corruption in
so you don't see that as being a way that President Putin could get out of this?
No, this is certainly not a way, and they've done this over the years. I'm afraid that what the Kremlin has been so good at earlier, manipulation, sophisticated operations, is now giving way to more and more violence and more brutality and harder authoritarianism. Authoritarianism we've had for many years now, but it used to be softer. It's much harder, and it's getting harder and harder. And it doesn't seem, and this is, of course, what Navalny strove at, there is no good option for the Kremlin right now. If the Kremlin, which is not likely, if it is soft on Navalny, Navalny certainly is the winner. If he is released, goes under house arrest even, instead of incarceration, still, this shows that he is the winner, that the Kremlin was forced to get softer, not harder. But if the Kremlin uses violence and brutality big time, still, it doesn't make it look stronger. There is no good option. And it doesn't make it look stronger because this, of course, alienates the people and antagonizes the people. And in the fall, in September this year, we're having a parliamentary election. And the chief pro-Kremlin force, United Russia Party, is not very popular as is. It's not that it has strong competitors. But this would mean that in order for the party to gain decent support, the Kremlin will have to opt for fraud. And fraud comes at a cost. Of course, they can do this, but this comes at a cost. So the more people are alienated and antagonized by violence, and of course, you know, not too many people took to the streets compared to Russia's over 140 million people, but they have families and they have friends and with social networks, with YouTube, everything. You know, about a dozen YouTube channels reported from the streets live. So people know what is going on, especially younger people. So it comes at a cost, and the Kremlin does not have a good way out. And what's more, increasingly it looks that Navalny actually is rising to be on par with the president of the country. Of course, there are a lot of very important people in Russia, but as a public politician, I think Navalny is now rising to the stature of a national figure. And this is, of course, not what the Kremlin wanted. And as Navalny makes fun of Putin and desacralizes him in his video, Putin becomes, you know, a subject of jokes, a subject of memes, of political joking. So we'll see whether his ratings go down significantly, but I expect that there will be a decline. What Putin can no longer be is his nation's uniter. He was a uniter for a long time. People agreed, even though those who were not very fond of him still agree that there's no alternative to him. But I think this current political crisis, because we are in the middle of a political crisis that the Kremlin will get over gradually, but still there is no way that Putin will reemerge from this crisis as the same leader of no alternative, uncontested and unchallenged. Whereas there is no reason to expect that the current protest actually will end in toppling the government, in a big political change. Still, something has moved, something has shifted. And tentatively, it can be said that Putin might with time become a liability for his establishment, not an asset. And that's an important development that cannot be underestimated. It's not the Kremlin that sets the agenda now. The Kremlin responds. It responds brutally. And it has, of course, full control over law enforcement, over state security. There have been no defections from the establishment. Of course not, not even close.
And always a challenge, though, is that you don't have defections until you have defections, and then they could come pretty rapidly. And I mean, you and I have been in the political science business for a while. No one knows how to predict when that moment comes. But I'm curious, I want to pick up on a thread there. You mentioned sort of the view of Putin as a uniter, and you've also noted that he is in a political crisis and he's hoping he can contain it. He may not be able to. I've heard a lot of rumblings, guessing, suppositions that perhaps one way President Putin will try to end the crisis is to create a distraction and turn people's attention away and to do something on the foreign policy front that might unify Russians. You know, you go back and many Russians were quite happy and applauded the seizure of Crimea. I don't want to relitigate that, but I'm curious, do you see any potential that Russia's foreign policy may become more aggressive because of the political crisis President Putin currently faces?
Well, I would say that even if Russian foreign policy becomes more aggressive, this is not going to win too many hearts and minds in Russia. Yeah. Crimea was absolutely unique. Actually, the sense that Crimea is Russian had been there ever since the collapse of the Soviet Union. Any public opinion poll over the years that asked the question of whether Crimea should be Russian actually got responses from a vast majority, an almost overwhelming majority of Russians, that yes, Crimea is Russian and should be Russian. People were not ready to fight for it or to take action in that direction, but those sentiments were common among the at least some of the elites, and certainly among the broad public. So when that happened, it was like a realization of a dream. It was actually a gift Putin gave to his nation that cost at that time nothing at all to the nation, not economically, not, thank God, in terms of human lives. It was this wonderful present of the leader to his nation that the nation appreciated, and the mood after the annexation of Crimea was euphoric in Russia. It was not just people hailed the very fact that Crimea was now ours. It was like a rallying cry, Crimea is ours, Krym nash in Russian, Crimea is ours. But also it was like, you know, when you're in love and everything looks better immediately. And people responded in public opinion polls more positively about just any policy that the question was asked about. Is the crime lower in Russia? Yes, it is. Is the problem of drug addiction not as acute as it used to be? Yes, it is now. Everything is better. It was such an upsurge of euphoria, of triumph, actually made even stronger by the fact that the West was punishing Russia for what Russia and Russians regarded as a realization of their dream, as something that made them feel strong and proud. But there is no other Crimea, not Donbass in eastern Ukraine, not territories that used to be part of Georgia and now nominally independent. I don't think Russian people care one way or another, whether they are part of Russia or independent. There is nothing like that. And in general, you know, I would give one example. During the war between Armenia and Azerbaijan recently, a majority of Russians said they didn't care one way or another who wins. But what they were particularly about, that Russia should not interfere. And even the situation in Donbass, that was a bloody war.
This is in eastern Ukraine.
In eastern Ukraine, as an aftermath of the annexation of Crimea, was not as popular, especially after a while. It was popular early on, but then, and the Kremlin tried very hard to conceal any casualties that took place in eastern Ukraine, where Russia had its servicemen, but pretended that it didn't.
Maria, I want to close, if we can, by sort of moving away from Moscow and looking at countries that are very interested in what is happening in Russia. Obviously, European capitals have been critical of the jailing of Mr. Navalny. The Biden administration has weighed in and argued that Mr. Navalny should be released. I'm curious, from your point of view, what advice would you have for foreign capitals? Is this a time when they should be stepping up pressure on Moscow? Is this a time when countries should just sort of stand back and not try to influence the course of the debate, something else?
Well, of course, I'm not in a position to give advice to foreign leaders. What I can say is the support that foreign capitals and people in the European countries have shown to Navalny actually raises his stature even further. He's now a global figure. There's even talk about, nominating him for a Nobel Prize. Actually, he's now more than a national politician in Russia. He is, of course, a figure of global stature. But I think trying to exert pressure on the Russian government has never worked. I think one thing that I think foreign leaders have learned or should have learned during the long period of Putin's tenure of his leadership is that he does not bend to pressure. The confrontation with the West is now a fact. Russia has been under sanctions for a long time. I don't think Putin expects an improvement of our relations with the West, with the United States, or with Europe, but neither is he vulnerable to pressure. And what is even more important to me as a Russian is that if any positive political change is in store for my country, it should come from within, not from the outside.
On that note, I'll close up the President's Inbox for this week. My guest has been Maria Lippmann, Senior Associate for the Program on New Approaches to Research and Security in Eurasia at the George Washington University. There she hosts the PONARS Eurasia podcast. Maria, I have to ask, how can people find your podcast?
PONARS has a website, and my podcast is quite visible there.
Okay, so it's PONARS, P-O-N-A-R-S. Maria, thank you very much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Please subscribe to the President's Inbox on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and leave us a review. They help us get noticed and improve the show. As always, opinions expressed on the President's Inbox are solely those of the host or our guest, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's episode was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Zoe was also our recording engineer. Thanks, Zoe. Special thanks go out to Margaret Gatch for her assistance. This is Jim Lindsay. Thanks for listening.